Merci. The phone went dead again.
Smart, Noonan observed. They'll have 2 surveillance cameras on the bus all the way in, so we can't use it to screen a rescue team. And they probably plan to use the mountaineer technique to get the hostages aboard. Tough shit, he didn't add.
Bear, this is 6, Clark called on the radio. Bear, copy, 6, over. We execute in 5 minutes. Roger that. We party in 5. Malloy turned in his seat. Chavez had heard the call and nodded, holding up one hand, fingers spread. Rainbow, this is 6. Stand 2. Repeat, stand 2. We commence the operation in 5 minutes. In the underground, Peter Covington led 3 of his men east toward the castle stairwells, while the park engineer selectively killed off the surveillance cameras. His explosives man set a small charge on the fire door at the bottom and nodded at his boss. Team 1 is ready.
Rifle 2-1 is ready and on target, Johnston said.
Rifle 2-2 is ready, but no target at this time, Weber told Clark.
3, this is 1. The scanner crackled in the command room.
Yes, 1, the man atop the castle replied.
Anything happening?
No, 1. The police are staying where they are. And the helicopter is flying around somewhere but not doing anything.
The bus should be here in 15 minutes. Stay alert.
I will, 3 promised.
Okay, Noonan said. That's a time stamp. Mr. 1 calls Mr. 3 about every 15 minutes. Never more than 18, never less than 12, so...
Yeah, Clark nodded.
Move it up?
Why not? Stanley said.
Rainbow, this is 6. Move in and execute. Say again, execute now.
Aboard the Nighthawk, Sergeant Nance moved left and right, sliding the side doors open. He gave a thumbs up to the shooters that they returned, each man hooking up his zipline rope to D-rings on their belts. All of them turned inward, getting up on the balls of their feet so that their backsides were now dangling outside the helicopter.
Sergeant Nance, I will flash you when we're in place.
Roger, sir, the crew chief replied, crouching in the now empty middle of the passenger area, his arms reaching to the men on both sides.
Andre, go down and look at the courtyard, Rene ordered.
His man moved at once, holding his Uzi in both hands.
Somebody just left the room, Noonan said.
Rainbow, this is 6. 1 subject has left the command center.
8, Chavez thought. 8 subjects to take down. The other 2 would go to the long rifleman.
The last 200 meters were the hard ones, Malloy thought. His hands tingled on the cyclic control stick, and as many times as he'd done this, this one was not a rehearsal.
Okay.
He dropped his nose, heading toward the castle, and without the anti-collision lights, the aircraft would only be a shadow slightly darker than the night. Better yet, the 4-bladed rotor made a sound that was non-directional. Someone could hear it, but locating the source was difficult, and he needed that to last only a few more seconds.
Rifle 2-1, stand by.
Rifle 2-1 is on target 6, Johnston reported. His breathing regularized and his elbows moved slightly, so that only bone, not muscle, was in contact with the mat under him. The mere passage of blood through his arteries could throw his aim off. His crosshairs were locked just forward of the sentry's ear.
On target, he repeated.
Fire, the earpiece told him.
Say good night, Gracie, a small voice in his mind whispered.
His finger pushed back gently on the set trigger, which snapped cleanly, and a gout of white flame exploded from the muzzle of the rifle. The flash obscured the sight picture for a brief moment, then cleared in time for him to see the bullet's impact. There was a slight puff of gray-looking vapor from the far side of the head, and the body dropped straight down like a puppet with cut strings. No one inside would hear the shot, not through thick windows and stone walls from over 300 meters away.
Rifle 2-1, target is down, center head. Johnston reported. That's a kill, Lieutenant Harrison breathed over the intercom. From the helicopter's perspective, the destruction of the sentry's head looked quite spectacular. It was the first death he'd ever seen, and it struck him as something in a movie, not something real. The target hadn't been a living being to him, and now it would never be. Yep, Malloy agreed, easing back on the cyclic. Sergeant Nance, now! In the back, Nance pushed outward. The helicopter was still slowing, nose up now, as Malloy performed the rocking chair maneuver to perfection. Chavez pushed off with his feet and went down the zipline. It took less than 2 seconds of not-quite-free-fall before he applied tension to the line to slow his descent, and his black, rubber-soled boots came down lightly on the flat roof. He immediately loosed his rope and turned to watch his people do the same. Eddie Price ran over to the sentry's body, kicked the head over with his boot, and turned, making a thumbs up for his boss. Six, this is Team 2 lead, on the roof. The sentry is dead, he said into his microphone. Proceeding now. With that, Chavez turned to his people, waving his arms to the roof's periphery. The Nighthawk was gone into the darkness, having hardly appeared to have stopped at all. The castle roof was surrounded by the battlements associated with such places, vertical rectangles of stone behind which archers could shelter while loosing their arrows at attackers. Each man had one such shelter assigned, and they counted them off with their fingers, so that every man went to the right one. For this night, the men looped their rappelling ropes around them, then stepped into the gaps. When all of them were set up, they held up their hands. Chavez did the same, then dropped his as he kicked off the roof and slid down the rope to a point a meter to the right of a window, using his feet to stand off the wall. Paddy Connolly came down on the other side, reached to apply his primacord around the edges, and inserted a radio detonator on one edge. Then Paddy moved to his left, swinging on the rope as though it were a jungle vine to do the same to one other. Other team members took flashbang grenades and held them in their hands. 2 lead to 6. Lights! In the command center, the engineer again isolated the power to the castle and shut it off. Outside the windows, Team 2 saw the windows go dark, and then a second or two later, the wall-mounted emergency lights came on, just like miniature auto headlights, not enough to light the room up properly. The TV monitors they were watching went dark as well. Merde, René said, sitting and reaching for a phone. If they wanted to play more games, then he could... He thought he saw some movement outside the window and looked more closely. Team 2, this is lead. 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3. At 3, the men holding the flashbangs pulled the pins and set them right next to the windows, then turned aside. 2, 1, fire! Sergeant Connolly pressed his button, and 2 windows were sundered from the wall by explosives. A fraction of a second later, 3 more windows were blown in by a wall of noise and blazing light. They flew across the room in a shower of glass and lead fragments, missing the children in the corner by 3 meters. Next to Chavez, Sergeant Major Price tossed in another flashbang, which exploded the moment it touched the floor. Then Chavez pushed outward from the wall, swinging into the room through the window, his MP-10 up and in both hands. He hit the floor badly, falling backward, unable to control his balance, then felt Price's feet land on his left arm. Chavez rolled and jolted to his feet, then moved to the kids. They were screaming with alarm, covering their faces and ears from the abuse of the flashbangs. But he couldn't worry about them just yet. Price landed better, moved right as well, but turned to scan the room. There. It was a bearded one holding an Uzi. Price extended his MP-10 to the limit of the sling and fired a 3-round burst right into his face from 3 meters away. The force of the bullet impacts belied the suppressed noise of the shots. Oso Vega had kicked his window loose on leg power alone and landed right on top of a subject, rather to the surprise of both. But Vega was ready for surprises, and the terrorist was not. Oso's left hand slammed out, seemingly of its own accord, and hit him in the face with enough force to split it open into a bloody mess that a burst of 3 10-millimeter rounds only made worse. René was sitting at his desk, the phone in his hand,
and his pistol on the tabletop before him. He was reaching for it when Pierce fired into the side of his head from 6 feet away. In the far corner, Chavez and Price skidded to a stop, their bodies between the terrorists and the hostages. Ding came to one knee, his weapon up while his eyes scanned for targets, as he listened to the suppressed chatter of his men's weapons. The semi-darkness of the room was alive now with moving shadows. Loisel found himself behind a subject, close enough to touch him with the muzzle of his submachine gun. This he did. It made the shot an easy one, but sprayed blood and brains all over the room. One in the corner got his Uzi up, and his finger went down on the trigger, spraying in the direction of the children. Chavez and Price both engaged him, then McTyler as well, and the terrorist went down in a crumpled mass. Another had opened a door and raced through it, splattered by bullet fragments from a shooter whose aim was off and hit the door. This one ran down, away from the shooting, turning one corner, then another, and tried to stop when he saw a black shape on the steps. It was Peter Covington, leading his team up. Covington had heard the noise of his steps and taken aim, then fired when the surprised-looking face entered his sights. Then he resumed his race topside with four men behind him. That left three in the room. Two hid behind desks, one holding his Uzi up and firing blindly. Mike Pierce jumped over the desk, twisting in midair as he did so, and shot him three times in the side and back. Then Pierce landed, turned back, and fired another burst into the back of his head. The other one under a desk was shot in the back by Paddy Connolly. The one who was left stood, blazing away wildly with his weapon, only to be taken down by no fewer than four team members. Just then the door opened and Covington came in. Vega was circulating about, kicking the weapons away from everybody, and after 5 seconds shouted, "Clear!" "Clear," Pierce agreed. Andre was outside, in the open and all alone. He turned to look up at the castle.
"Dieter!" Homer Johnston called.
"Yes?"
"Can you take his weapon out?"
The German somehow read the American's mind. The answer was an exquisitely aimed shot that struck Andre's submachine gun just above the trigger guard. The impact of the 300 Winchester Magnum bullet blasted through the rough, stamped metal and broke the gun nearly in half. From his perch 400 meters away, Johnston took careful aim and fired his second round of the engagement. It would forever be regarded as a very bad shot. Half a second later, the 7-millimeter bullet struck the subject 6 inches below the sternum. For Andre, it seemed like a murderously hard punch. Already the match bullet had fragmented, ripping his liver and spleen as it continued its passage, exiting his body above the left kidney. Then, following the shock of the initial impact, came a wave of pain. An instant later, his screech ripped across the 100 acres of World Park.
"Check this out," Chavez said in the command center. His body armor had 2 holes in the torso. They wouldn't have been fatal, but they would have hurt.
"Thank God for DuPont, eh?"
"Miller time," Vega said with a broad grin.
"Command, this is Chavez. Mission accomplished. The kids..." "Uh-oh, we got one kid hurt here. Looks like a scratch on the arm. The rest of them are all okay. Subjects all down for the count, Mr. C. You can turn the lights back on."
As Ding watched, Oso Vega leaned down and picked up a little girl.
"Hello, querida.
Let's find your mamacita, eh?"
"Rainbow!" Mike Pierce exulted. "Tell him there's a new sheriff in town, people!"
"Bloody right, Mike."
Eddie Price reached into his pocket and pulled out his pipe and a pouch of good Cavendish tobacco. There were things to be done. Vega, Pierce, and Loisel collected the weapons, safed them, and stacked them on a desk. McTyler and Connolly checked out the restrooms and other adjacent doors for additional terrorists, finding none. Scotty waved to the door.
"Okay, let's get the kids out," Ding told his people.
"Peter, lead us out."
Covington had his team open the fire door and man the stairway, one man on each landing. Vega took the lead, holding the 5-year-old with his left arm, while his right continued to hold his MP-10. A minute later, they were outside.
Chavez stayed behind, looking at the wall with Eddie Price. There were 7 holes in the corner where the kids had been, but all the rounds were high, into the drywall paneling.
"Lucky," Chavez said.
"Somewhat," Sergeant Major Price agreed.
"That's the one we both engaged in. He was just firing, not aiming, and maybe at us, not them, I think."
"Good job, Eddie."
"Indeed," Price agreed. With that, they both walked outside, leaving the bodies behind for the police to collect.
"Command, this is Bear. What's happening? Over."
"Mission accomplished. No friendlies hurt."
"Well done, Bear," Clark told him.
"Roger, and thank you, sir. Bear is RTB. Out."
"I need to take a piss," the Marine told his co-pilot, as he horsed the Nighthawk west for the airfield.
Homer Johnston fairly ran down the steps of the dive bomber ride, carrying his rifle and nearly tripping 3 times on the way down. Then he ran the few 100 meters to the castle. There was a doctor there, wearing a white coat and looking down at the man Johnston had shot.
"How is he?" the sergeant asked when he got there.
It was pretty clear. The man's hands were holding his belly, and were covered with blood that looked strangely black in the courtyard lighting.
"He will not survive," Dr. Weiler said.
Maybe if they were in a hospital operating room right now, he'd have a slim chance, but he was bleeding out through the lacerated spleen, and his liver was probably destroyed as well. And so, no, absent a liver transplant, he had no chance at all, and all Weiler could do was give him morphine for the pain. He reached into his bag for a syringe.
"That's the one shot the little girl," Johnston told the doctor.
"I guess my aim was a little off," he went on, looking down into the open eyes and the grimacing face that let loose another moaning scream. If he'd been a deer or an elk, Johnston would have finished him off with a pistol round in the head or neck. But you weren't supposed to do that with human targets.
"Die slow, you fuck," he didn't say aloud.
It disappointed Johnston that the doctor gave him a pain injection, but physicians were sworn to their duty, as he was to his.
"Pretty low," Chavez said, coming up to the last living terrorist.
"Guess I slapped the trigger a little hard," the rifleman responded. Chavez looked straight in his eyes.
"Yeah, right. Get your gear."
"In a minute." The target's eyes went soft when the drug entered his bloodstream, but the hand still grabbed at the wound, and there was a puddle of blood spreading from under his back. Finally, the eyes looked up at Johnston one last time.
"Good night, Gracie," the rifleman said quietly.
10 seconds later, he was able to turn away and head back to the dive bomber to retrieve the rest of his gear. There were a lot of soiled underpants in the medical office, and a lot of kids still wide-eyed in shock, having lived through a nightmare that all would relive for years to come. The Rainbow Troopers fussed over them. One bandaged the only wound, a scratch, really, on a young boy. Centurion de la Cruz was still there, having refused evacuation. The troops in black stripped off their body armor and set it against the wall. And he saw, on their uniform jackets, the jump wings of paratroopers, American, British, and German, along with the satisfied look of soldiers who'd gotten the job done.
"Who are you?" he asked in Spanish.
"I'm sorry, I can't say," Chavez replied. "But I saw what you did on the videotape."
"You did well, Sergeant."
"So did you, huh?"
"Chavez. Domingo Chavez."
"American?"
"Si."
"The children. Were any hurt?"
"Just the one over there."
"And the criminals?"
"They will break no more laws, amigo." "None at all," Team 2 lead told him quietly.
"Bueno."
De la Cruz reached up to take his hand.
It was hard?
It is always hard, but we train for the hard things, and my men are...
They have the look,
De La Cruz agreed.
So do you.
Chavez turned.
Hey, guys, here's the one who took him on with a sword.
Oh, yeah?
Mike Pierce came over.
I finished that one off for you.
Ballsy move, man.
Pierce took his hand and shook it. The rest of the troopers did the same.
I must...
De La Cruz stood and hobbled out the door. He came back in 5 minutes later, following John Clark, and holding...
What the hell is that? Chavez asked.
The Eagle of the Legion.
6th Legio Victrix,
the centurion told them, holding it in one hand.
The Victorious Legion.
Señor Dennis, con permiso?
Yes, Francisco, the park manager said with a serious nod.
With the respect of my legion, Señor Chavez, keep this in a place of honor.
Ding took it. The damn thing must have weighed 20 pounds, plated as it was with gold. It would be a fit trophy for the club at Hereford.
We will do that, my friend, he promised the former sergeant, with a look at John Clark.
The stress was bleeding off now, to be followed, as usual, by elation and fatigue. The troopers looked at the kids they'd saved, still quiet and cowed by the night, but soon to be reunited with their parents. They heard the sound of a bus outside. Steve Lincoln opened the door and watched the grown-ups leap out of it. He waved them through the door, and the shouts of joy filled the room.
"Time to leave," John said.
He, too, walked over to shake hands with De La Cruz as the troops filed out. Out in the open, Eddie Price had his own drill to complete. His pipe now filled, he took a kitchen match from his pocket and struck it on the stone wall of the medical office, lighting the curved briar pipe for a long, victorious puff as parents pushed in and others pushed out, holding their children, many weeping at their deliverance. Colonel Gamelin was standing by the bus and came over.
"You are the Legion?" he asked.
Louis Loisel handled the answer.
"In a way, monsieur," he said in French.
He looked up to see a surveillance camera pointed directly at the door, probably to record the event, the parents filing out with their kids, many pausing to shake hands with the Rainbow Troopers. Then Clark led them off, back to the castle, and into the underground. On the way, the Guardia Civil cops saluted, the gestures returned by the Special Ops troopers. Chapter 16 Discovery. The successful conclusion of the World Park operation turned out to be a problem for some, and one of them was Colonel Tomas Nuncio, the senior officer of the Guardia Civil on the scene. Assumed by the local media to be the officer in command of the operation, he was immediately besieged with requests for details of the operation, along with videotapes for the TV reporters. So successful had he been in isolating the theme park from press coverage that his superiors in Madrid themselves had little idea what had taken place, and this also weighed on his decision. So the colonel decided to release World Park's own video coverage, deeming this to be the most innocuous footage possible, as it showed very little. The most dramatic part had been the descent of the shooting team from the helicopter to the castle roof, and then from the roof of the castle to the control room windows. And that, Nuncio decided, was pure vanilla, lasting a mere 4 minutes. The time required for Paddy Connolly to place his line charges on the window frames and move aside to detonate them. Nothing of the shooting inside the room had been taped, because the terrorists had themselves wrecked the surveillance camera inside the facility. The elimination of the castle roof sentry had been taped, but was not released due to the gruesome nature of his head wound. And the same was true of the killing of the last of them, the one named Andre, who had killed the little Dutch girl. Which scene had also been recorded, but was withheld for the same reason. The rest was all let go.
The distance of the cameras from the actual scene of action prevented the recognition or even the sight of the faces of the rescue team. Merely their jaunty steps outside, many of them carrying the rescued children. That, he decided, could harm or offend no one. Least of all the special operations team from England, who now had one of the tricornio hats from his force to go along with the eagle of World Park's notional 6th Legion as a souvenir of their successful mission. And so the black-and-white video was released to CNN, Sky News, and other interested news agencies for broadcast around the world, to give substance to the commentary of various reporters who'd assembled at World Park's main gate, there to comment, at great and erroneous length, about the expertise of the Guardia Civil's special action team dispatched from Madrid to resolve this hateful episode at one of the world's great theme parks. It was 8 o'clock in the evening when Dmitri Arkadyevich Popov saw it in his New York apartment, as he smoked a cigar and sipped a vodka neat while his VCR taped it for later detailed examination. The assault phase, he saw, was both expert and expected in all details. The flashes of light from the explosives used were dramatic and singularly useless for showing him anything. And the parade of the rescuers as predictable as the dawn, their springy steps, their slung weapons, and their arms full of small children. Well, such men would naturally feel elation at the successful conclusion of such a mission, and the trailing footage showed them walking off to a building, where there must have been a physician to take care of the one child who'd sustained a minor injury during the operation, as the reporters said. Then, later, the troops had come outside, and one of them had swiped an arm against the stone wall of the building, lighting a match, which he used to light a pipe. To light a pipe, Popov saw. He was surprised at his own reaction to that. He blinked hard, leaning forward in his seat. The camera didn't zoom in, but the soldier, policeman in question, was clearly smoking a curved pipe, puffing the smoke out every few seconds as he spoke with his comrades. Doing nothing dramatic, just talking unrecorded words calmly, as such men did after a successful mission, doubtless discussing who had done what. What had gone according to plan, and what had not. It might as easily have been in a club or bar, for trained men always spoke the same way in those circumstances, whether they were soldiers or doctors or football players, after the stress of the job was concluded and the lessons learned phase began. It was the usual mark of professionals, Popov knew. Then the picture changed, back to the face of some American reporter, who blathered on until the break for the next commercial, to be followed, the anchorman said, by some political development or other in Washington. With that, Popov rewound the tape, ejected it, and then reached for a different tape. He inserted it into the VCR, then fast-forwarded to the end of the incident in Bern, through the takedown phase and into the aftermath where, yes, a man had lit a pipe. He'd remembered that from watching from across the street, hadn't he? Then he got the tape of the press coverage from the Vienna incident, and, yes, at the end, a man had lit a pipe. In every case it was a man of about 180 centimeters in height, making much the same gesture with the match, holding the pipe in exactly the same way, gesturing to another with it in exactly the same manner, the way men did with pipes.
Ah, Nichevo,
the intelligence officer said to himself in the expensive high-rise apartment. He spent another half an hour queuing and rerunning the tapes. The clothing was the same in every case. The man the same size, the same gestures and body language, the same weapons slung the same way, the same everything, the former KGB officer saw. And that meant the same man. In 3 separate countries. But this man was not Swiss, not Austrian, and not Spanish. Next, Popov backed off his deductive thoughts, searching for other facts he could discern from the visual information he had there. There were other people visible in all the tapes. The pipe smoker was often attended by another man, shorter than he, to whom the pipe smoker appeared to speak with some degree of friendly deference. There was another around, a large muscular one, who in two of the tapes carried a heavy machine gun, but in the third, carrying a child, did not. So, he had two and maybe a third man on the tapes who had appeared in Bern, Vienna, and Spain. In every case, the reporters had credited the rescue to local police. But no, that wasn't the truth, was it? So, who were these people who arrived with the speed and decisiveness of a thunderbolt in three different countries, twice to conclude operations that he had initiated, and once to settle one begun by others? And who they had been, he didn't know or especially care. The reporters said that they'd demanded the release of his old friend, the Jackal. What fools! The French would as soon toss Napoleon's corpse from Les Invalides as give up that murderer. Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, named with Lenin's own patronymic by his communist father. Popov shook that thought off. He just discovered something of great importance. Somewhere in Europe was a special operations team that crossed international borders as easily as a businessman flying in an airliner, that had freedom to operate in different countries, that displaced and did the work of local police, and did it well, expertly. And this operation would not hurt them, would it? Their prestige and international acceptability would only grow from the rescue of the children at World Park.
Nichevo, he whispered to himself again.
He'd learned something of great importance this night, and to celebrate he poured himself another vodka. Now he had to follow it up. How? He'd think that one over, sleeping on the thought, trusting his trained brain to come up with something. They were nearly home already. The MC-130 had picked them up and flown the now relaxed team back to Hereford, their weapons repacked in the plastic carrying cases, their demeanor not the least bit tense. Some of the men were cutting up. Others were explaining what they'd done to team members who'd not had the chance to participate directly. Mike Pierce, Clark saw, was especially animated in his conversation with his neighbor. He was now the Rainbow Kill leader. Homer Johnston was chatting with Weber. They'd come to some sort of deal, something agreed between them. Weber had taken a beautiful but out-of-policy shot to disable the terrorist's Uzi, allowing Johnston to... Of course, John told himself. He didn't just want to kill the bastard who'd murdered the little girl. He'd wanted to hurt the little prick, to send him off to hell with a special, personal message. He'd have to talk to Sergeant Johnston about that. It was outside of Rainbow policy. It was unprofessional. Just killing the bastards was enough. You could always trust God to handle the special treatment. But, well, John told himself, he could understand that, couldn't he? There had once been that little bastard called Billy to whom he'd given a very special interrogation in a recompression chamber. And though he remembered it with a measure of pain and shame, at the time he'd felt it justified. And he'd gotten the information he'd needed at the time, hadn't he? Even so, he'd have to talk with Homer, advise him never to do such a thing again. And Homer would listen, John knew. He'd exorcised the demons once, and once, usually, was enough. It must have been hard for him to sit at his rifle, watching the murder of a child, the power to avenge her instantly right there in his skilled hands, and yet do nothing. "Could you have done that, John?" Clark asked himself, not really knowing what the answer was in his current exhausted state. He felt the wheels thump down on the Hereford runway, and the props roar into reverse pitch to slow the aircraft. Well, John thought, his idea, his concept for Rainbow, was working out rather well, wasn't it? Three deployments, three clean missions. Two hostages killed, one before his team deployed to Bern, the other just barely after their arrival in the park.
neither one the result of negligence or mistake on the part of his men. Their mission performance had been as nearly perfect as anything he'd ever seen. Even his fellow animals of Third Sog in Vietnam hadn't been this good, and that was something he'd never expected to say or even think. The thought came suddenly, and, just as unexpectedly, came the near need for tears, that he might have the honor to command such warriors as these, to send them out and bring them back as they were now, smiling as they stood, hoisting their gear on their shoulders, and walking to the open rear cargo door on the Herky Bird, behind which waited their trucks. His men. "The bar is open," Clark called to them when he stood.
"A little late, John," Alistair observed.
"If the door's locked, we'll have Paddy blow it," Clark insisted, with a vicious grin. Stanley considered that and nodded.
"Quite so. The lads have earned a pint or two each."
Besides which, he knew how to pick locks. They walked into the club, still wearing their ninja suits, and found the barman waiting. There were a few others in the club as well, mainly SAS troopers, sipping at their last call pints. Several of them applauded when the Rainbow Team came in, which warmed the room. John walked to the bar, leading his men, and ordering beer for all.
"I do love this stuff," Mike Pierce said a minute later, taking his Guinness and sipping through the thin layer of foam.
"Two, Mike?" Clark asked.
"Yeah," he nodded. "The one at the desk, he was on the phone."
"Tap, tap," Pierce said, touching two fingers to the side of his head. "Then another one, shooting from behind a desk. I jumped over and gave him three on the fly. Landed, rolled, and three more in the back of the head. So long, Charlie. Then one more got a piece of him, along with Ding and Eddie. Ain't supposed to like this part of the job.
I know that. But Jesus, it felt good to take those fuckers down.
Killing kids, man. Not good.
Well, they ain't gonna be doing any more of that, sir.
Not with the new sheriff in town."
"Well, nice going, Mr. Marshall," John replied, with a raised glass salute.
There'd be no nightmares about this one, Clark thought, sipping his own dark beer. He looked around. In the corner, Weber and Johnston were talking, the latter with his hand on the former's shoulder, doubtless thanking him for the fine shot to disable the murderer's Uzi. Clark walked over and stood next to the two sergeants.
"I know, boss," Homer said, without being told anything. "Never again. But goddamn, it felt good."
"Like you said, never again, Homer."
"Yes, sir."
"Slap the trigger a little hard," Johnston said, to cover his ass in an official sense.
"Bullshit," Rainbow Six observed.
"I'll accept it. Just this once."
"And you, Dieter. Nice shot, but—"
"Mi vida, Herr General."
"I know, sir."
The German nodded his submission to the moment.
"Homer, Junge, the look on his face when you hit him. Ah, that was something to see, my friend. Good for the one on the castle roof, too."
"Easy shot," Johnston said dismissively. "He was standing still. Zap. Easier in throwing darts, pal." Clark patted both on the shoulder and wandered over to Chavez and Price.
"Did you have to land on my arm?" Ding complained lightly.
"So, next time, come through the window straight, not at an angle."
"Right."
Chavez took a long sip of the Guinness.
"How'd it go?" John asked them.
"Aside from being hit twice, not bad," Chavez replied. "I have to get a new vest, though." Once hit, the vests were considered to be ruined for further use. This one would go back to the manufacturer for study to see how it had performed.
"Which one was that, you think, Eddie?"
"The last one, I think. The one who just stood and sprayed at the children."
"Well, that was the plan, for us to stop those rounds. And that one went down hard. You, me, Mike, and Oso, I think, took him apart.
Whatever cop had recovered that body would need a blotter and a freezer bag to collect the spilled brains."
"That we did," Price agreed as Julio came over.
"Hey, that was okay, guys," First Sergeant Vega told them, pleased to have finally participated in a field operation.
"Since when do we punch our targets?" Chavez asked. Vega looked a little embarrassed.
"Instinct, he was so close.
You know, probably could have taken him alive, but... well, nobody ever told me to do that, you know."
"That's cool, Oso. That wasn't part of the mission, not with a room full of kids."
Vega nodded.
"Well, I figured, and the shot was pretty automatic, too, just playing like we practice, man. Anyway, that one went down real good, Jefe."
"Any problem on the window?" Price wanted to know.
Vega shook his head. "Nah, gave it a good kick, and it moved just fine. Bumped a shoulder coming through the frame, but no problems there. I was pretty pumped. But you know, you should have had me cover the kids. I'm bigger. I would have stopped more bullets."
Chavez didn't say that he'd worried about Vega's agility. Wrongly, as it had turned out. An important lesson learned. Bulky as Oso was, he moved lightly on his feet, far more so than Ding had expected. The bear could dance pretty well, though at 225 pounds he was a little large for a tutu.
"Fine operation," Bill Tawney said, joining the group.
"Anything develop?"
"We have a possible identification on one of them, the chap who killed the child. The French ran the photo through some police informants, and they think it might be an André Hare, Parisian by birth, thought to be a stringer for Action Direct once upon a time, but nothing definite. More information is on the way, they say. The whole set of photos and fingerprints from Spain is on its way to Paris now for follow-up investigation. Not all of the photos will be very useful, I am told."
"Yeah, well, a burst of hollow points will rearrange a guy's face, man," Chavez observed with a chuckle. "Not a hell of a lot we can do about that."
"So, who initiated the operation?" Clark asked.
Tawney shrugged.
"Not a clue at this point. That's for the French police to investigate."
"Would be nice to know. We've had 3 incidents since we got here. Isn't that a lot?" Chavez asked, suddenly very serious.
"It is," the intelligence officer agreed.
"It would not have been 10 or 15 years ago, but things had quieted down recently."
Another shrug.
"Could be mere coincidence, or perhaps copycatting, but..."
"Copycat? I shouldn't think so, sir," Eddie Price observed.
"We've given bloody little encouragement to any tear who has ambitions, and today's operation ought to have a further calming effect on those people."
"That makes sense to me," Ding agreed. "Like Mike Pierce said, there's a new sheriff in town, and the word on the street ought to be don't fuck with him, even if people think we're just local cops with an attitude. Take it a step further, Mr. C."
"Go public?"
Clark shook his head.
"That's never been part of the plan, Domingo."
"Well, if the mission's to take the bastards down in the field, that's one thing. If the mission is to make these bastards think twice about raising hell, to stop terrorist incidents from happening at all, then it's another thing entirely. The idea of a new sheriff in town might just take the starch out of their backs and put them back to washing cars or whatever the hell they do when they're not being bad. Deterrence, we call it, when nation-states do it. Will it work on a terrorist mentality?"
"Something to talk with Doc Bellow about, John," Chavez concluded.
And again Chavez had surprised him, Clark realized. 3 straight successes, all of them covered on the TV news, might well have an effect on the surviving terrorists in Europe or elsewhere with lingering ambitions, mightn't it? And that was something to talk to Paul Bellow about. But it was much too soon for anyone on the team to be that optimistic.
"Probably," John told himself with a thoughtful sip.
The party was just beginning to break up. It had been a very long day for the Rainbow Troopers, and one by one they set their glasses down on the bar, which ought to have closed some time before, and headed for the door for the walk to their homes. Another day and another mission had ended, yet another day had already begun, and in only a few hours they'd be awakened to run and exercise and begin another day of routine training.
"Were you planning to leave us?"
the jailer asked inmate Sanchez in a voice dripping with irony.
"What do you mean?" Carlos responded.
"Some colleagues of yours misbehaved yesterday," the prison guard responded, tossing a copy of Le Figaro through the door.
"They will not do so again."
The photo on the front page was taken off the World Park video, the quality miserably poor, but clear enough to show a soldier dressed in black carrying a child, and the first paragraph of the story told the tale. Carlos scanned it, sitting on his prison bed to read the piece in detail, then felt a depth of black despair that he'd not thought possible. Someone had heard his plea, he realized, and it had come to nothing. Life in this stone cage beckoned as he looked up to the sun coming in the single window. Life. It would be a long one, probably a healthy one, and certainly a bleak one. His hands crumpled the paper when he'd finished the article. Damn the Spanish police. Damn the world.
"Yes, I saw it on the news last night," he said into the phone as he shaved.
"I need to see you. I have something to show you, sir," Popoff's voice said, just after 7 in the morning.
The man thought about that. Popoff was a clever bastard who'd done his jobs without much in the way of questions. And there was little in the way of a paper trail, certainly nothing his lawyers couldn't handle if it came to that. And it wouldn't. There were ways of dealing with Popoff, too, if it came to that.
"Okay, be there at 8:15.
"Yes, sir," the Russian said, hanging up. Pete was in real agony now, Kilgore saw. It was time to move him. This he ordered at once, and two orderlies came in dressed in upgraded protective gear to load the wino onto a gurney for transport to the clinical side. Kilgore followed them and his patient. The clinical side was essentially a duplication of the room in which the street bums had lounged and drunk their booze, waiting unknowingly for the onset of symptoms. He now had them all, to the point that booze and moderate doses of morphine no longer handled the pain. The orderlies loaded Pete onto a bed, next to which was an electronically operated Christmas tree medication dispenser. Kilgore handled the stick and got the IV plugged into Pete's major vein. Then he keyed the electronic box, and seconds later the patient relaxed with a large bolus of medication. The eyes went sleepy, and the body relaxed, while the Shiva continued to eat him alive from the inside out. Another IV would be set up to feed him with nutrients to keep his body going, along with various drugs to see if any of them had an unexpectedly beneficial effect on the Shiva. They had a whole roomful of such drugs, ranging from antibiotics, which were expected to be useless against this viral infection, to interleukin-2, and a newly developed 3A, which, some thought, might help, plus tailored Shiva antibodies taken from experimental animals. None were expected to work, but all had to be tested to make sure they didn't, lest there be a surprise out there when the epidemic spread. Vaccine B was expected to work, and that was being tested now with the new control group of people kidnapped from Manhattan bars, along with the notional Vaccine A, whose purpose was rather different from B. The nanocapsules developed on the other side of the house would come in very handy indeed. As was being demonstrated, even as he had the thought, looking down at Pete's dying body. Subject F4, Mary Bannister, felt sick to her stomach. Just a mild queasiness at this point, but didn't think much of it. That sort of thing happened, and she didn't feel all that bad. Some antacids would probably help, and those she got from her medicine cabinet, which was pretty well stocked with over-the-counter medications. Other than that, she felt pretty mellow, as she smiled at herself in the mirror and liked what she saw, a youngish, attractive woman wearing pink silk jammies. With that thought, she walked out of her room,
her hair glossy and a spring in her step. Chip was in the sitting room, reading a magazine slowly on the couch, and she made straight for him and sat down beside him. "Hi, Chip," she smiled. "Hi, Mary." He smiled back, reaching to touch her hand. "I upped the Valium in her breakfast," Barbara Archer said in the control room, zooming the camera in, "along with the other one." The other one was an inhibition reducer. "You look nice today," Chip told her, his words imperfectly captured by the hidden shotgun microphone. "Thank you." Another smile. "She looks pretty dreamy." "She ought to be," Barbara observed coldly. "There's enough in her to make a nun chuck her habit and get it on." "What about him?" "Oh, yeah. Don't give him any steroids." Dr. Archer had a little chuckle at that. In proof of which, Chip leaned over to kiss Mary on the lips. They were alone in the sitting room. "How's her blood work look, Barb?" "Loaded with antibodies, and starting to get some small bricks. She ought to be symptomatic in another few days." "Eat, drink, and be merry, people, for next week you die," the other physician told the TV screen. "Too bad," Dr. Archer agreed. She showed the emotion one might display on seeing a dead dog at the side of the road. "Nice figure," the man said, as the pajama tops came off. "I haven't seen an X-rated movie in a long time, Barb." A videotape was running, of course. The experimental protocol was set in stone. Everything had to be recorded so that the staff could monitor the entire test program. "Nice tits," he thought, about the same time Chip did, right before he caressed them on the screen. "She was fairly inhibited when she got here. The tranquilizers really work, depressing them that way." Another clinical observation. Things progressed rapidly from that point on. Both doctors sipped their coffee as they watched. Tranquilizers or not, the baser human instincts charged forward. And within 5 minutes, Chip and Mary were humping madly away, with the usual sound effects, though the picture, blessedly, wasn't all that clear. A few minutes later, they were lying side by side on the thick shag rug, kissing tiredly and contentedly, his hand stroking her breasts, his eyes closed, his breathing deep and regular as he rolled onto his back. "Well, Barb, if nothing else, we have a pretty good weekend getaway for couples here," the man observed with a sly grin. "How long do you figure on his blood work?" 3 or 4 days until he starts showing antibodies, probably." Chip hadn't been exposed in the shower, as Mary had. "What about the vaccine testers?" 5 with A. We have 3 left as uncontaminated controls for B testing." "Oh? Who are we letting live?" "M2, M3, and F9, Dr. Archer replied. "They seem to have proper attitudes. One's a member of the Sierra Club, would you believe? The others like it outdoors, and they should be okay with what we're doing." "Political criteria for scientific tests?" "What are we coming to?" the man asked with another chuckle. "Well, if they're going to live, they might as well be people we can get along with," Archer observed. "True." A nod. "How confident are you with B?"
"Very. I expect it to be about 97% effective. Perhaps a little better," she added conservatively.
"But not 100%?
"No, Shiva's a little too nasty for that," Archer told him. "The animal testing is a little crude, I admit, but the results follow the computer model almost exactly, well within the testing error criteria. Steve's been pretty good on that side."
"Berg's pretty smart," the other doctor agreed. Then he shifted in his chair. "You know, Barb, what we're doing here isn't exactly
I know that, she assured him. But we all knew that coming in.
True.
He nodded submission, annoyed at himself for the second thoughts. Well, his family would survive, and they all shared his love of the world and its many sorts of inhabitants. Still, these two people on the TV, they were humans, just like himself. And he'd just peeped in on them like some sort of pervert. Oh, yeah, they'd only done it because both were loaded with drugs fed to them through their food or in pill form. But they were both sentenced to death and...
Relax, will you? Archer said, looking at his face and reading his mind.
At least they're getting a little love, aren't they? That's a hell of a lot more than the rest of the world'll get.
I won't have to watch them.
Being a voyeur wasn't his idea of fun, and he'd told himself often enough that he wouldn't have to watch what he'd be helping to start.
No, but we'll know about it. It'll be on the TV news, won't it?
But then it will be too late. And if they find out, their last conscious act will be to come after us. That's the part that has me worried.
The Project Enclave in Kansas is pretty damn secure, Barb, the man assured her. The one in Brazil's even more so.
Which was where he'd be going eventually. The rainforest had always fascinated him.
Could be better, Barbara Archer thought.
The world isn't a laboratory, Doctor, remember?
Wasn't that what the whole Shiva project was about, for Christ's sake?
Christ, he wondered. Well, another idea that had to be set aside.
He wasn't cynical enough to invoke the name of God into what they were doing. Nature, perhaps, which wasn't quite the same thing, he thought.
"Good morning, Dmitri," he said, coming into his office early.
"Good morning, sir," the intelligence officer said, rising to his feet as his employer entered the anteroom. It was a European custom, hearkening back to royalty, and one that had somehow conveyed itself to the Marxist state that had nurtured and trained the Russian now living in New York.
"What do you have for me?" the boss asked, unlocking his office door and going in.
"Something very interesting," Popov said. "How important it is, I am not certain. You can better judge that than I can."
"Okay, let's see it."
He sat down and turned in his swivel chair to flip on his office coffee machine. Popov went to the far wall and slid back the panel that covered the electronics equipment in the woodwork. He retrieved the remote control and keyed up the large screen TV and VCR. Then he inserted a video cassette.
"This is the news coverage of Bern," he told his employer.
The tape only ran for 30 seconds before he stopped it, ejected the cassette, and inserted another.
"Vienna," he said then, hitting the play button.
Another segment, which ran less than a minute. This he also ejected.
"Last night at the park in Spain."
This one he also played. This segment lasted just over a minute before he stopped it.
"Yes," the man said, when it was all over.
"What did you see, sir?"
"Some guy smoking."
"The same guy, you're saying?"
"Correct. In all three incidents, the same man, or so it would appear."
"Go on," his employer told Popov.
"The same special operations group responded to and terminated all three incidents. That is very interesting."
"Why?"
Popov took a patient breath. This man may have been a genius in some areas, but in others he was a babe in the woods.
"Sir, the same team responded to incidents in three separate countries, with three separate national police forces, and in all three cases, this special team took over from those three separate national police agencies and dealt with the situation. In other words, there is now some special internationally credited team of special operations troops. I would expect them to be military rather than policemen, currently operating in Europe. Such a group has never been admitted to in the open press. It is, therefore, a black group, highly secret. I can speculate that